This podcast is a part of the Policies That Perpetuate Systemic Racism project, supported by the Canada Race Relations Foundation. Join us as we explore the impact of the policy Zero Tolerance for Barbaric Cultural Practices Act. Through insightful conversations, we aim to shed light on the real-world consequences. We aim to shed light on the real-world consequences of this policy.
In our previous three episodes, we have explored the intricate issues associated with the policy Zero Tolerance for Barbaric Cultural Practices Act, focusing on its cultural implications, stereotypes regarding immigrant communities, and broader concerns. Yet, the bill's problems extend further. Scholars, activists, and community workers have underscored the harm stemming from criminalizing gender-based violence. Feminist scholars highlight that punitive measures often fail to adequately support survivors, especially those from marginalized communities. The criminalization of violence has deep-seated repercussions. In this episode, we will delve deeper into these aspects. We'll examine the policy's intended legal impacts, its real-life effects, and the consequences of criminalizing gender-based violence on survivors. First, let's recap the legal changes that were made under this legislation. As you may recall, the bill aimed to counter quote-unquote harmful cultural practices such as forced marriages, child marriages, and polygamy. The bill did this by amending three existing laws: the Criminal Code, Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, and the Civil Marriage Act. The Immigration and Refugee Protection Act was changed to demarcate polygamy as a criteria for inadmissibility in the country. The Civil Marriage Act was changed to classify legal age of marriage as 16. And the Criminal Code was changed to add forced marriage as an offense, making it punishable by up to 5 years in prison. To set the stage, I would like to introduce Deepa Mathu, a lawyer, activist, and the executive director of Canada's Barbara Schleifer Commemorative Clinic, who has been working with survivors of gender-based violence for more than two decades. Deepa has been intricately involved in both the groundwork leading up to the policy changes and advocating in the aftermath of these shifts.
I think the biggest harm and biggest loss that I grieve is the loss of momentum. The loss of that conversation, education, training that was being collaboratively looked at and funded. I think because the resources went into the criminalizing and the resources went into creating dissent against the criminalizing, there was obviously almost like a diversion that got created to what was happening. And in its own way, some of that education and training work and some of that collaborative work is continuing. Like at the clinic, for example, I can share with you that we continue to provide assistance to survivors, especially the ones who are being brought back into the country as repatriation because they were taken abroad. At times they are already married and brought back. Sometimes they are not, and they're just stuck and they are able to come back before that happens. So I know that the organizations who are engaged with the issue are still continuing to provide that support and provide that assistance and do the education work. But clearly, it slowed down the whole thing. I feel that the policy change and legal changes happen on a platform that sometimes doesn't, like the average Canadian going about their life, would not understand. Canada doesn't exist in isolation. It exists on an international platform. The change to law and policy for the issues such as forced marriage happens on that international platform. It is inspired by what Canada needs to showcase to the international world in terms of their actions. And so that's one aspect of it that sometimes we don't see. So that is one reason why it happened. And the second reason was that there was studies, some research, like really at a very grassroots level, happening to show that this issue is prevailing in our communities. And there was efforts made for education, efforts made for interdepartmental collaborations, efforts being made for a proper risk assessment and safety planning and finding ways and solutions to support survivors if they were stuck abroad, to bring them back and create framework of bringing them back into the country and making sure that they were adjusting back into their lives here safely and so on and so forth. The school and education system was being engaged. The health system was being engaged. And then in the middle of all this, while we're still as a society and as a civil society, as well as a community, still unpacking what needs to happen, we get a change to the criminal code as one of the big changes in the policy with this bill. And then we organized to voice dissent and say, this is wrong, this is incorrect. And one of the fears, the biggest fear that I remember time and again repeating was that by doing this, unfortunately, the whole issue will get pushed under the rug and that you would silence the communities and that the issue will stop being discussed. And that's exactly what happened. So almost now, 8 years later, 9 years later, we are talking about it. But the reality is the number of cases coming forward slowed down. The conversation slowed down. The movement of organizing to support survivors slowed down. It's very difficult for me to draw the positives, other than the fact, as where I started, that at the international arena level, there is something that Canada has done. Canada has criminalized forced marriages. Canada has created a new peace bond framework, which people can get access a peace bond if they are under threat of being removed from the country. Canada has denied any possibility of any second partner being sponsored into the country by way of the sponsorship of the spouse or a partner or a conjugal partner. And yes, it was criminalized. And if it was properly applied and properly executed, where, you know, the courts and the police officers and the policy decision makers and judges were all trained into understanding the implication of this form of violence, maybe something could have still be said about it. But unfortunately, none of that has happened. When the bill came into existence, I had already done a number of things as part of my work, right? I was doing a lot of workshops locally, but I had actually literally gone around across coast to coast in Canada in various different cities and done trainings with colleagues. We had created a risk assessment tool, which was, again, had gone coast to coast. There were other organizations which had, like the organization I work at right now, they had a youth group creating preventive work and modules for peer support and so on and so forth. There was a lot of work that was already happening. And that is the work, unfortunately, that became the impetus. The research studies that we had done became the impetus for bringing the change forward. While the change that we were asking was diagonally opposite of it, we had categorically said, do not criminalize forced marriage as one of the recommendations. There were a series of recommendations that we had put out.
Why did these legislative changes push the issue further underground instead of supporting survivors? To understand that, one must understand that immigrant women often face various barriers accessing the legal justice system in the first place. Sabrina Zrock, National Legal Services Coordinator at Canadian Council of Muslim Women, explains these barriers further.
In a very logistical way, we could say, for example, language and communication barriers. So for Muslim women where English is not their forte, it's not their first language, then seeking help generally on that front could be difficult. Finding translators, quality translators could be very difficult. I see a lot of financial barriers. I work exclusively with Muslim women and girls, but I'm sure that financial barriers are a barrier that many other disenfranchised groups deal with. I think financial barriers are a big hindrance in seeking quality help. There's also like a lack of awareness of what we can do and what our rights are, especially when it comes to, for example, marriage. Muslims who, when we get married in Canada or abroad and we live in Canada, there are different rights. And so understanding the differences between Muslim family laws and then the family laws of within here could be very different. And then there's also just like the piece about reinforcing harmful narratives. So you don't really want to, when you seek help and you feel like you're reinforcing those narratives, it could make it difficult to seek help. And then there's also stigmatization and isolation. So Muslim women may face cultural stigmatization and isolation within their communities if they speak out about abuse or seek help. And again, this is not just a Muslim issue. You see a lot of women who go through, whether it's divorces or they leave an abusive partner, Muslim or not, they very often may face forms of isolation within their own environments. And so that could deter people from seeking help. There are some social barriers, and then it depends on the intersection with the person.
In the current system, one's gender, race, immigration status, culture, religion, all impact the kind of legal support they can get. Deepa explains the connection between immigration status and the legal justice system.
One of the biggest barriers is the language, because not all immigrant women have access to English or French, or even if they have access to English or French, the way you speak in English and French can also be very different. The expression can be very different, right? And that expression sometimes changes your access to resources, and that expression sometimes changes your access to help, supports and help. And that I see is another big barrier. And third one being is your immigration status in itself, right? So when you are sometimes on a precarious immigration status, you are on a traumatic journey of uprooting yourself from one place to another, sometimes forcefully, sometimes by choice. In both of those scenarios, you are in a situation of precarity, which actually creates this inherent fear of taking a step, because you're thinking that if I take a step right now, what will be the implications of that for myself, my community, my family, my people? And there is an extra burden of layer of burden that survivors are shouldering. And it makes it more complex for them to, again, make any choices or decisions. The list is long, but these are some of them that I can share with you that makes it more difficult for them to make decisions. In terms of what makes them more vulnerable, again, goes back to the theory of intersectionality that Kimberly Crenshaw gave us, that intersectional experiences of that, that's just not immigration status that we are talking about. We're talking about poverty, lack of education. We're talking about lack of access to resources, the racism and the xenophobia and homophobia in some cases. Like, all of those things together create an environment which makes them more vulnerable. So it's not that one thing. So that this is that they are immigrant or non-status or refugees. It's the mix of those things, right? Like when you're homeless, or you have lack of some kind of stable housing, you don't have a job, you are experiencing racism, when you talk, even if you're talking in English, people are saying, pardon, excuse me, what do you mean? Like, all of those microaggressions and oppressions at multiple levels that people experience when they are in this country, that is what creates vulnerability. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's just one thing. These issues have to be seen from the lens of intersectionality. And I think for the forced marriage also, it's the same thing, right? Like, it's not one thing why people experience forced marriages.
If you may recall, in the last episode, Shalini discussed the way stereotypes continue to impact the kind of legal support survivors can receive. These issues, as Deepa and Sabrine explain, inherently serve as a barrier for racialized women. Let's hear further from Shalini on her thoughts on the criminalization aspect of this law.
By creating the legislation in the first place, this issue that we had with the legislation and survivors and people dealing with forced marriage came with us and spoke to committee and government about this was that criminalizing forced marriage, which is what was done through that legislation, is not going to do anything. And the reality is, I'm a practicing lawyer, and I have yet to actually come across a case where somebody's been charged under those sections this many years later. And there's two reasons for that. One, I think police forces are reluctant to do it because they know the backlash. But two, the bigger reason and what clients told the government and people facing forced marriage told the government was, I want your support. I don't want to call the police and have my brother or my sister or my mom or my dad charged and arrested. That's not what we're looking for. And we had told the government of the day that doing this, criminalizing this, would push people further underground. They would not come out and seek services. And that's exactly what happened. And then we take it forward. And as we move through time and up to today, we can see actually the implications of this type of legislation on the thinking of people from across Canada around South Asian communities. It's not... You can make a link between those conversations and creating that level of systemic racism and discrimination on what's happening now in terms of violence against these communities, right up to murders, hate crimes, attacks, things that happen in workplaces, things that happen in public spaces. And so we haven't advanced as much as we have wanted to, but the reality is those conversations started way back with the Barbaric Cultural Practices Act. Probably open the door to the level of hate that we see now in Canada for our own communities, South Asian communities, and a number of other marginalized communities across the country.
Shalini questions the use of the Immigration Act to counter gender-based violence while giving the overall context to conversations happening at that time.
The changes in immigration that sort of stemmed from this whole conversation around forced marriage led to things like the creation of conditional PR and more investigations for misrepresentation. So if you said I was forced to get married and come here, there was a period of time where immigration would turn around and say, well, then you lied to us to get your status, so we're going to investigate you, right? As the victim of violence, we're going to investigate you and potentially remove you. And that was held over people's heads in terms of if you complain or if you leave a situation, we will have you deported. And, you know, I used to be able to tell clients at some point in time, that's not true. You know, your partners don't have the power to deport you. But after we kept seeing partners call immigration and then investigation after misrepresentation after investigation, it kind of became true, right? That these people who would leave forced marriages and situations of violence were put under the gun. And the other piece was that immigration legislation is often used as a tool of racism and discrimination against racialized communities. It happens in the South Asian diaspora, it happens for Asian countries, and it most certainly happens for African countries, right? And so in response to being tough on gender-based violence, let's create policy to keep more people out.
Yeah.
Right. That's the, in essence, what happened in the immigration setting. Let's create policy to keep more people out. Let's create policy to scrutinize marriages from this part of the country because they all have to be forced marriages. None can be genuine. None can be arranged marriages. There was a complete confusion around these two things are not the same.
Yeah.
And if you come via an immigration mechanism, let's also make legislation that comes after you for lying to us. Let's forget about the fact that the misrepresentations were made because you were the victim of violence. You had no choice. So let's forget about that. Let's also investigate you, right? And so it was a disastrous time. Luckily, things like conditional permanent residence has been repealed after tremendous advocacy across the country from gender-based violence activists and clients. But, you know, we still don't have in our immigration legislation any kind of solid legislated protection for people who want to leave these situations. And to me, when you do that, you're telling someone stay in your situation, yeah. Right? Am I going to leave if I don't know whether that means I'll end up having to be removed from Canada? Probably not. And so I think those changes around immigration were a disaster. They were not, in my view, intended to support people facing violence. They were intended to punish our communities and punish people facing violence.
Elaborating further on the laws on polygamy, Shalini continues.
Those were targeted changes against Muslim communities. Let's just be frank about it, right? We don't have to dance around it. Those changes were, and the title, Barbaric Cultural Practices Act, and those immigration changes in particular were targeted at Muslim communities in the South Asian community in particular, right? And, you know, there wasn't enough nuance thinking about what does that mean, right? In fact, I had a number of clients who came to Canada on visitor visas who didn't actually even realize that the person they thought they were marrying was already married, right? And they're the people who will be removed.
Yeah.
We didn't do anything, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it's a tricky conversation. I, too, am not in favor of polygamy, but also I'm not blind to the fact that despite that it is illegal here, that it still happens, right? And there are reasons for that. And that our response shouldn't be, let's punish everybody. Our response should be, we need to think about how do we support people who in these situations are really just are victims of violence, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And we are not doing a good job in that field. But I do have to say, in terms of immigration, we have come some distance, right, from that horrible period of time of those changes. But we haven't come far enough. We have public policies. We talk a lot about it, but I work in that system every day trying to get status for clients who have faced violence, and it is hard.
In this episode, we engaged with three experts from the legal justice system to understand the impact of criminalizing gender-based violence on survivors. We discovered that the culturalization of violence and prevalent stereotypes act as a significant barrier, hindering individuals from immigrant communities from accessing necessary care and support. Immigrant women, because of their unique positionality, are often vulnerable to these obstacles within the legal justice system. In our next episode, we will continue to unravel the effects of this criminalization, exploring further how it disempowers survivors and fosters an environment marked by fearfulness and helplessness. Thank you for tuning in today. Join us in the next episode for more insightful discussions and expert perspectives.